Chapter 10 Fever. The storm never came. When Rachel returned in the mid-afternoon, she and Lako went straight to the chief and reported on events in the other village. She spoke to Nate and Javy. She was tired and wanted to sleep before they discussed business. Later, she and Nate walked down toward the river to the narrow bench under the trees. They sat close, their knees touching again.
"Every village has a local doctor," Rachel said. "He cooks plants and roots to make his medicine. He calls up spirits to help with all sorts of problems. These doctors are my enemies. I'm a threat to their religion. They attack Christians. In a village down the river, I had a small school where I taught reading and writing. It was for the Christians, but it was also open to anyone. A year ago we had malaria, and three people died. The local doctor told the village chief that the people were sick because of my school. They were being punished. The school is now closed. The parents of the girl who died are Christians. The local doctor said he could have saved the girl, but the parents didn't call him. He blamed me for her death. And he blamed God. During the funeral today, he began dancing and singing. I couldn't finish the service." Her voice cracked slightly, and she bit her lip. She couldn't cry in front of the Indians. She had to be strong all the time. But she could cry with Nate, and he would understand. "I think you should go now," she said suddenly. "I think I saw a case of malaria in the other village today. Mosquitoes carry it, and it spreads quickly. Trust me, Nate, I've had malaria twice, and you don't want it. The second time almost killed me." It never occurred to Nate that she might die. If she died, it would take years to settle the Phelan estate. And he admired her greatly. She was everything he wasn't, strong and brave, happy, with a simple life. "Don't die, Rachel," he said. "You're a good man. You have a good heart and a good mind. You just need some help."
"I know. I'm not very strong." He had the papers in his pocket. "Can we discuss these?" She read the will slowly. "Troy didn't care for his other children," she said. "I remember the day my mother told me about him. My father had just died. Troy had found me and wanted to visit. She told me the truth about my biological parents, and it meant nothing to me. A year went by. He and my mother became friends over the phone. One day he came to our house. We had cake and tea. Then he left. He sent money for college. He started acting like a father, and I grew to dislike him. Then my mother died. I changed my name and went to medical school. I prayed for Troy over the years, the same way I pray for all the lost people. I thought he'd forgotten about me." He gave her the other legal documents. She read them carefully and said, "I'm not signing anything. I don't want the money. And I want you to do something for me. Don't tell anyone where I am." This would be a huge news story. Humble missionary in jungle says no to $11 billion fortune. The journalists would come to the Pantanal with helicopters and boats to get the story. Nate felt sorry for her. "I'll do what I can," he said. The chief and some of the villagers came to watch them leave. "You're sure we'll be safe in the dark?" Nate asked. "Yes, the chief is sending his best men to guide you. God will protect you. Say your prayers. You're a good person with a good heart." "Thank you. You want to get married?"
"I can't."
"Sure you can. I'll take care of the money.
You take care of the Indians. We'll get a bigger hut and throw away our clothes. They both laughed. Nate stood to say goodbye, and for a second he couldn't see. His eyelids began to ache. The joints at his elbows hurt. Standing ankle-deep in water, Nate put his arms around Rachel and said, "Thanks."
"Thanks for what?"
"Oh, I don't know. Thanks for creating a fortune in legal fees." She smiled and said,
"I like you, Nate,
but I don't care about the money and the lawyers.
Please don't come back. Just tell your people you never found me."
As they moved away, he waved at Rachel and the Indians. At the first turn in the river, he glanced over his shoulder. Rachel and the Indians hadn't moved. He was sweating, even though it was cool. His arms and legs were wet. "I'm sick," he thought. Javy noticed him and after a few minutes said, "Nate, are you okay?" He shook his head no, and pain shot from his eyes to his spine. "Javy, I think I have malaria."
"How do you know?"
"Rachel warned me. She saw it in the other village yesterday. That's why we left today. I have a fever, and I can't see." Javy stopped the boat and shouted to the Indians. He quickly unrolled the tent. "You will feel cold and shiver," he said as he worked. "Have you had malaria?"
"No, but most of my friends have died from it."
"What?" "Bad joke. It doesn't kill many, but you will be very sick." Moving gently, keeping his head as still as possible, Nate lay down in the center of the boat. Javy spread the tent over him and secured it with two empty gas tanks. The Indians were beside them. Laco asked Javy what was happening. Nate heard the word malaria. Then they left. Twice the canoes slowed as the Ipikas discussed which fork of the river to take. Javy kept their boat 100 meters behind. He couldn't see Nate under the tent, but he knew his friend was suffering. Laco was concerned about the American.
"What should I tell the missionary about him?" he asked Javy.
"Tell her he has malaria."
Nate heard their voices. The fever burned him from head to toe. His skin and clothes were wet. His mouth was so dry that it hurt to open it. The storm followed them but didn't catch them. Javy thought they would find Welly in the Santa Lura by dawn. The Indians were tired and ready to stop. Finally, they found a spot and landed. Laco explained that he'd been the missionary's assistant for many years. He'd seen lots of cases of malaria. He looked at Nate. "A very high fever," he told Javy. "The fever would go away, but there would be another attack in 48 hours. The oldest guide began talking to Laco. He translated for Javy, telling him to keep in the center of the river. In 2 hours, they would find the Paraguay. Javy thanked the Indians and followed the moon to the Paraguay. He arrived at the mouth of the Cabitha an hour after dawn. The Santa Lura was not there. Javy went to find the owner of a nearby house, who told him about the storm that took away the boat.
"Where did it sink? What happened to the boy?"
"I don't know," the old man said. "He may be dead."
Nate wasn't dead. The fever went down, and when he woke, he was cold and thirsty. He opened his eyes with his fingers. Every part of his body ached. There was a hot rash on his neck and chest.
"Where are we?" he asked Javy.
"We're at the Cabitha. Welly is not here. The boat sank in a storm. Can you make it to Corumbá?"
"I'd rather just die. Lie down, Nate."
They left the bank and went on toward Corumbá. In the afternoon, they stopped at Fernando's store. Fernando looked at Nate.
"This is not malaria," he said, touching the rash on Nate's neck. "Malaria does not produce a rash like this. Dengue does. It's similar to malaria. Fever, sore muscles and joints, spread by mosquitoes. You need to get him to Corumbá as quickly as possible."
It was almost 2:30. Corumbá was 9 to 10 hours away. Nate woke once, but couldn't see. He woke again, and it was dark. He tried to say something to Javy about water, just a small drink. But his voice had gone. Rachel lay beside him under the smelly tent, her knees just touching his. He wanted to kiss her on the cheek. "When was your last kiss?" he wanted to ask her. She was there to stop him dying. The fevers rose and fell. She patted his arm and promised he wasn't going to die. "She tells everybody this," he thought. "Death would be welcome." The touching stopped. He opened his eyes and reached for Rachel, but she was gone. In Corumbá, Valdir called a doctor friend and persuaded him to meet them at the hospital. They raced through town in Valdir's car, ignoring lights and signs.
"Did you find the woman?" Valdir asked Javy. "What did she say?"
"I don't know. I didn't really talk to her. I think she liked our friend back there."
Nate was curled tightly in the back seat, hearing nothing. The doctor studied the rash, which began at Nate's chin and stopped at his waist. He was covered with mosquito bites.
"Looks like dengue fever," he said after 10 minutes.
Because he was a rich American, Nate got the best drugs in the hospital. The fever dropped a little. The sweating stopped.
"His temperature should fall soon," the doctor told the nurse. "I'll see him again early in the morning."
Nate was sleeping heavily when the nurse took him into a room with 5 other patients. He didn't see the open sores, the uncontrolled shaking of the old man next to him. He couldn't smell the waste. Like his father, Rex Phelan was good with numbers. He realized that 6 law firms were doing the same work. 6 firms fighting the same fight, each wanting a big slice of the pie. It was time for the family to get together. He decided to begin with his brother, T.J. The 2 brothers met in secret. Rex began with a Sneed story.
"This is enormous," he said. "It could make or break our lawsuit. Sneed will say he was the only person with Dad when he wrote the will. He wanted $5 million, but he only wants $500,000 now. We'll find some way not to pay him the rest. We have 6 law firms all attacking the same will, and they all expect to get rich when we settle. How much are your boys getting?"
"How much is Hark Geddes getting?" Troy asked.
25%. "Mine wanted 30. We agreed on 20.
Troy Jr. was proud that he'd made a better deal than Rex.
"Let's play with numbers," Rex continued. "Imagine we hire Sneed, and he says all the right things. The estate wants to settle. We each get maybe $20 million. 5 goes to Hark Geddes, 4 goes to your boys, that's 9, so we get 31. But if we join up, then Hark will cut his fee. We don't need all these lawyers, TJ.
"I hate Hark Geddes. Why don't we fire him and stick with my guys?"
"Because Hark found Sneed. This is a nasty business. Hark understands it. If we work together, he'll take 20%. If we can bring in Mary Ross, then he'll cut it to 17.5. Libigale, down to 15.
"There's no sense fighting," Troy Jr. said sadly.
"It'll cost us a fortune. It's time to make peace."
Sneed arrived for a meeting with Hark Geddes with a contract he'd written himself. Hark signed it and handed over a check for $500,000. Sneed examined every word, then folded it and put it in his coat pocket.
"What was the old man's state of mind the morning he died?" Hark asked.
Sneed wanted to say the right thing.
"He was out of his mind."
"How much time did you spend with him?"
"Off and on, 24 hours a day. I was on call around the clock."
"Who else did he spend time with?"
"Maybe young Nicolette, the secretary. He liked her."
"Did he have sex with her?"
"Would it help the lawsuit?"
"Yes."
"Then they had sex all the time."
Hark smiled. "Look, Mr. Sneed, this is what we want. We need to know all the strange things Troy Phelan said and did. Sit down and begin writing. Talk to Nicolette. Make sure they were having sex. Listen to what she says."
"She'll say anything we need." "How much time do I have?"
"We would like to video you in a few days. We'll hear your stories, ask you questions, then we'll coach you. When things are perfect, you'll be ready to talk to the judge." Sneed left in a hurry. He wanted to put the money in the bank and buy a new car. Nicolette needed one, too.